Greetings, ladies and gentlemen, boys and girls. Welcome to the Brian Dainsburg Podcast, Christian Living in a Complicated World. I'm your host, Brian Dainsburg, lead pastor of Alliance Bible Church, and we are on to the hot and somewhat recently hot subject of IVF, in vitro fertilization. It's become a front burner issue, and largely because of the Alabama Supreme Court ruling that came out not long ago. And the ruling was that frozen embryos created and stored in IVF clinics can be considered children under state law. And this decision obviously thrust IVF into the spotlight. And so how do we think about these things? Another complexity to our world, which is what this podcast is about. So let me say three real quick preliminary comments on it. First, my podcast on abortion dovetails with this one. I'm not going to rehash everything I said in that podcast here, but it would be worth listening to it. I think these two issues are ethically related. Second, it's important not to gloss over the pain of infertility. And the pain is not just a modern day phenomenon. It's a pain felt at various points in the Bible storyline. Sometimes people forget all three matriarchs. Sarah, Rebecca, and Rachel faced infertility. It's presented as an excruciating thing to endure. And so compassion needs to be shown to those dealing with it. The Bible understands this problem. It's not silent on it. And third, the scriptures tell us children are a blessing from the Lord. So it's understandable, and I would argue it's a good thing for us to make attempts to overcome infertility. I hope and pray that we're able to make progress toward that end in increasing measure. However, I don't think IVF is the best strategy. It's, when you get to realize what it is, it is problematic for Christians. Now, just to be clear, in vitro fertilization, IVF, is the process of joining a woman's egg and a husband's sperm in a lab rather than inside a woman's body. The Latin phrase in vitro means in glass. So when the egg is fertilized by the sperm, the result is a living embryo. And the idea is that you would implant this embryo in the woman's womb so that it can develop like any other baby. Sometimes that's all people understand about it, and it sounds benign, but there's more to it. Alan Schlemmen, who writes over at Stand to Reason, a really solid Christian apologetics website, Alan tells the following true story. I just want to read it. What would you do if you and your spouse were eager to have a child, but were told you had a 1 in a million chance of getting pregnant? That's the reality a couple I recently talked to faced. Due to a medical condition, it was virtually impossible for them to get pregnant unless they considered in vitro fertilization. So that's what they did. The couple went to a clinic, learned about the process, and signed up to begin. After all, it was a well-known facility with an excellent reputation for quote-unquote success. So they felt like the IVF team knew what they were doing and trusted them with the results. After going through the process of maturing the wife's eggs, removing the mature ones and fertilizing them with the husband's sperm, the IVF clinic sent the couple home to await the results of the fertilization process. They went back to the clinic, and that's when things got messy. The staff told them they successfully fertilized 29 eggs. That's right. The IVF clinic had created 29 human embryos, which meant this couple now had 29 offspring. Things got worse. The couple discovered that only 22 of their offspring were given a high health rating, and consequently, the IVF clinic had discarded 7 of them. The healthy 22 were resting comfortably in a freezer, awaiting transfer into the wife's womb. Before the couple knew anything about what had happened, the IVF clinic staff had created 29 of their children, killed 7 of them, and frozen the remaining 22. This pro-life Christian couple was distraught. Though they wanted to get pregnant, they would have never consented to such a disregard for human life, to creating and mistreating their own flesh and blood. But having not investigated the details or asked clarifying questions, they now realized the disturbing truth of what they had participated in. Now, I'll return to his article at the end because he has some good counsel to offer, but I would suspect that many Christians are in a similar boat to this couple. Many don't realize what's involved in IVF. And when we do, we begin to realize the arguments made against abortion fundamentally inform how we ought to think about IVF. Joe Carter wrote an article on this topic, and he talks about an interesting survey that was conducted. He writes this: "The question of when human life begins contains two interrelated queries about a specific type of being. When does a particular being become a human? And when does that being's existence constitute life? The answer is straightforward. Human life begins when the human sperm fertilizes a human ovum and creates a distinct human being capable of growth, functional activity, and continual change preceding death. This is known as the fertilization view. Fertilization is also known as conception, so it's accurate to say human life begins at conception." Carter continues, "Within the biology field, this view is uncontroversial." You heard that right. Within the biology field, this view, this fertilization view, is uncontroversial. A 2021 report published in Issues in Law and Medicine found that when biologists from 1,058 academic institutions around the world were asked when a human life begins, 96% affirmed the fertilization view. They actually surveyed 5,577 biologists, and 5,337 of them affirm the fertilization view. The report notes, in the two studies that explored experts' views on the matter, the fertilization view was the most popular perspective held by public health and IVF professionals. Some people, I think, are surprised to hear that. It's the fertilization view is the only common sense view. It's the leading scientific and empirical perspective on when a human life begins. So, if human life begins at conception, where does that leave IVF? If human life begins at conception, where does that leave IVF? Well, it goes back to a related question then. What is the unborn? Now, you could go the approach of the fertilization view and just survey the biologists, and you got that record, but why is that view held in such high regard, particularly by those who come from a Judeo-Christian ethic? I talked about Scott Klusendorf in his excellent book, The Case for Life. He's arguing against, again, abortion. These two are related. He used the acrostic SLED, S-L-E-D. Let me just mention the first three, S-L-E, and apply it to this issue of IVF. S stands for size. So again, we're going back to the question, what is the unborn? What is the unborn? S is size. The unborn, whether in utero or in vitro, is clearly smaller than a born human. It's hard to reason how a difference in size, though, disqualifies someone from being a person. A 4-year-old is smaller than a 14-year-old. Can we kill her because she's not as big as a teenager? No, because a human being's value is not based on their size. She's still equally a person, even though she differs in that characteristic. In the same way, the unborn, whether in utero or in vitro, is smaller than a 4-year-old. If we can't kill the 4-year-old because she's smaller, then we can't kill the unborn because she's smaller either. So that eliminates size as a factor. L is level of development. The unborn, whether in utero or in vitro, is also less developed than a born human being. How does this fact, though, disqualify the unborn from personhood? A 4-year-old girl can't bear children because her reproductive system is less developed than a 14-year-old girl. That doesn't qualify her from personhood. She is still as equally valuable as a childbearing teen. The unborn, whether in utero or in vitro, is also less developed than the 4-year-old. Therefore, we can't disqualify her from personhood for the same reason we can't disqualify the 4-year-old. Both are merely less developed than older human beings. So that throws out level of development as a dividing line. Third is environment. The unborn, whether in utero or in vitro, is located in a different environment than a born human. How does your location, though, affect your value? Can changing your environment alter your status as a person? Where you are has no bearing on who you are. An astronaut who spacewalks in orbit is in a radically different environment than a person on the planet. No one could reasonably deny this personhood, his personhood, simply because he's in a different location. Scuba divers who swim underwater and spelunkers who crawl through caves are equally as valuable as humans who ride in hot air balloons. If changing your environment can't change your fundamental status, then being inside or outside a petri dish can't be relevant either. And so important to both the abortion debate and the IVF debate is the question, what is the unborn? If we conclude the unborn are human, regardless of size, level development, or environment, then the deliberate eradication or discarding of human life is morally repugnant. And we could go to biblical examples where we're seeing how the unborn are perceived or how they're viewed. Exodus 21:20 explicitly calls the unborn a child. So the Hebrew word used to describe a 4-year-old is the same word used to describe an unborn child. You could legitimately say that a Hebrew way of thinking, in a Hebrew way of thinking, there's no difference in humanness or personhood between a born infant and the unborn. Psalm 139 tells us God creates the unborn just as he created Adam and Eve. So if that's the case, if God is creating the unborn, if he creates the unborn, imagine watching a sculptor working to shape an elaborate figure out of stone. And while she's engaged in this great feat, someone comes along, picks up, and smashes against the floor. Would anyone be outraged? Of course, we're dealing in that instance with stone, with abortion, or with the discarding of embryos created through IVF. We're dealing with life. Or Jeremiah chapter 1, verse 5, before I formed you in the womb, I knew you. And before you were born, I consecrated you. I appointed you a prophet to the nations. Notice God is addressing Jeremiah as though he is a person through the use of personal pronouns. So for these reasons, many Christians will be uncomfortable with IVF altogether. For those inclined to pursue it, Alan Schleman's counsel is wise. Here's what he says, after talking about this story with this couple who had no idea what they were getting into. He says this, "My advice has always been this. Don't create more embryos than the number of children you're willing to have. And don't implant more embryos in your womb than you're willing to carry at one time. If you're willing to have 4 children, create 4 embryos. If you're not willing to carry more than 1 at a time, don't implant more than 1 at a time. So this hopefully provides some clarity about the IVF issue. I know even the whole process is confusing to some people. Hopefully that clarifies how this is done. You don't want to be being like this couple who is shocked by what's involved. And in the meantime, as a church, we should be praying that we're able to discover ways of overcoming infertility that keeps human life sacred. Those who are working to develop these sorts of things are not always operating from a Christian worldview. They don't always have a biblical perspective on the processes employed to do these sorts of things. And so let's be praying that the Lord does use people who have a good view of the sanctity of human life to come up with and to help solve this problem. Well, that's it. Thanks for tuning in, and we'll see you next time.